you charged us to remind you, so I'm trying to remember.
We're talking about will?
Intention.
You were talking quite a bit about karma and reincarnation and how those practices were passed down, even though the Buddha didn't teach those specific things. And when you were talking about karma, you were characterizing it, if I remember correctly, as intention. Mm-hmm. And that there is some volition involved, but not agency, not a doer, not a person or a self-doing. And we were curious, some of us, to hear more about the intention part of that.
Right.
How can there be volition without a doer?
Well. So, we'll begin with intention. Yes, what the Buddha said is, he redefined karma. He said, when I say karma, I mean intention. And he repeats this in many different ways in different places. That thoughts become actions, and actions become habits. And this shapes the person that you are. But let's take this English word, intention. The word he used was cetana. And cetana, good translation for that is intention. But what do we mean by intention? So let's just get clear on that. What do you think intention is?
Something you do on purpose.
Something
you do on purpose.
Something you do on purpose, yes. That's very good. It has... That simple statement has a lot of things in it. The idea is a purpose. What is the intention? That can also be, what is the purpose, right? So something has an intention. There's an intention behind something if it has a purpose. Really, it's a very, that's a very interesting idea just to think about purpose. Some kind of goal. Some kind of objective, something that isn't now but you want to be in the future. And the other thing is something you do on purpose. So the intention, this is where you get, the intention's coming from somewhere. So like that thermostat on the wall, does it have a purpose? Where does its purpose come from?
Its purpose was innately endowed by its creator.
Yes, it was made with a purpose in mind. Right? So, it has a purpose, but that purpose, in that case, came by design. What would be some other examples of things that have a purpose?
Humans.
Our government.
Humans.
I still didn't hear.
Humans.
Humans. Humans. What is the purpose of humans?
I don't know.
Make more money.
Consume.
Well, but see, that's a good that's a question that sort of everybody sort of asks without realizing it is, you know. What's my purpose in life? Why am I here? What's the purpose of humans? And yet some people answer it exactly that way. Purpose, my purpose is to make money. I don't know exactly why, but what I've gathered from what's going on around me is that making money is a really good purpose. our culture really, it really conditions us to think of certain things, certain kinds of things as our purpose. Anyway, intention definitely has something to do with what happens in the future. And when we use the terms purpose and intention and things like that, there's no question that implicit in this is that purpose comes, some kind of consciousness we assume is there that forecasts the possibility of this outcome and then tries to set things in motion so that it will happen. So what's the purpose of leaves on a tree?
Photosynthesis.
Photosynthesis. Yeah, amongst other things, but yeah, photosynthesis. Now, is the tree the agent that looked ahead and said, well, in the future it will be good if I can photosynthesize, therefore I'm going to make leaves for that purpose? No. But if you feel like, well, that any purpose must come from some kind of sentience, some kind of consciousness, well, then you're automatically going to come to the conclusion like, well, must be some kind of deity that created the tree for the purpose, created the tree with the leaves for the purpose of doing photosynthesis. And for a long time, that's what a lot of people thought of it, but not everybody.
So perhaps purpose isn't innate. It's perceived by us. We assign purpose by observing it to exist,
yeah.
And its purpose is what we do.
Yeah.
It's so. I mean. I wanted to. I'm not being articulate about putting it on its head. Mm-hmm. Purpose doesn't come from the thing. Purpose comes from the observer.
Now, there's a very, very, very good observation. That's very good. The purpose comes from the observer. Yeah. Let's look at nature here. As a naturalist, if you look at a particular animal, and it has characteristics. Its fur is a certain color, and it has a certain kind of teeth, and it has claws and so forth. When we study nature, we basically examine all these different kinds of beings and their different parts and the way they work, and we think of it in terms of purpose, right? The claws have a purpose, and fangs have a purpose, and the fur of a particular color has a purpose, and so on and so forth throughout nature, at every level, trees, animals, insects. But most of us understand pretty clearly, I think, how all of these different things evolved through a process of, through chance, a particular characteristic arose, and if it fulfilled a purpose, then it became established. Not by any agency, but actually it's what we look at and say it's purpose. We look at the claws and we say, those claws have this purpose. But it's actually what those claws do that cause those claws to exist, right?
But could you say that the overriding purpose, wherever it comes from, is the perpetuation of life and survival? Survival and the perpetuation of life going on?
Well, yeah, let's look at that now. Because that's sort of taking exactly the thing we're talking about, sort of taking it up to the top level, so to speak. What is the purpose of life? The purpose of all these things is to perpetuate the beings that they're a part of, right?
Mm-hmm. Seems that way.
Right. And did somebody plant that?
Don't know.
Well, is it necessary that somebody would have planned that? See, what evolution tells us is that a lizard is the way a lizard is because proto-lizards that weren't that way
didn't survive.
Yeah. Right. So nobody planned that the lizard would be this way.
That's true.
Right? But in a sense, it gets kind of circular. It is because it is.
It is because it works. It works because it is.
It works because it is, and it is because it works. Yeah.
For that purpose, for that overriding purpose,
well,
to perpetuate survival.
So we could say, is there some sort of overriding universal purpose that things are? Well, we don't need to answer that, but in a sense, looking at evolution, not just biological evolution, evolution of stars and solar systems and the universe as a whole, we could say, well, it's sort of as if there was this one underlying purpose, is that so it could be. Right? And what is most successful at being
continues to be.
What's not so successful at being stops being. Yeah. But and now that's definitely at a level of metaphysics. Why is there something rather than nothing? That's that level of that. But what's important that I think that we did, I don't know if we all made the same journey together, but I think we went from simple, ordinary things that seem to have a built-in purpose to saying that none of the kinds of things we were talking about actually require a consciousness formulating a goal and purposely making it happen. That at least short of, you know, maybe there's a God that decided I want a universe, and so everything is so that that can be. But short of that, all these things in nature, the way that animals are, the way that stars and solar systems are, and so forth, we can account for simply on the basis of some things last and some things don't. So the result is some things are. And because there's this huge variety of different possibilities along the way, we have a great variety of ways that things can be, and we can look at it. And as you said, our kind of mind can look at it and say the purpose of the claws, or the purpose of the eye, or the purpose of the fin, or the purpose of the leaf being this particular shape, is so that this and this and therefore that. And we spontaneously, naturally, put it in terms as though we're presupposing a mind just like ours, planned it and made it happen.
Yeah. Could you use the synonym function for purpose?
Just function? Yeah. Its purpose is its function. Its function is its purpose.
I mean, you just keep saying the word purpose here, and it makes it more and more like you want to define it.
Well, that's good. Let's switch from purpose to function.
Or efficacy.
Or efficacy.
Yeah. This lizard it has efficacy at being a lizard.
Yeah. Or in a sense, isn't it just simple causality? Mm-hmm. If A, then B. Mm-hmm. It's simple causality. Those cats that had soft rubbery claws, their A didn't lead to B.
So, but then if you wanted to try and quiz the universe on why you are here, if you stand around and look at, well, lizards are here because they're very good at being lizards, wolves are here because they're very good at being wolves, then you have to stand around and say, what am I any good at? And, and that would be why you're here.
And that's all right. We're here because we're good at the same thing that the lizards and the wolves and everything else, and the leaves on the tree.
We're good at explaining?
No, we're here because we're good at being here.
Oh.
So how does this work?
Now, explaining mm-hmm. and planning and making thermostats are all ways that we're good at being. They're characteristics we have that contribute to our being.
But can't that get distorted in terms of people's intentions, getting back to intention? And you think that perhaps you want to self-preserve, so you have an intention that really is negative. Mm-hmm. But you're distorted because you think you're so separate and small that you feel you have to do it that way. And so how does that work into the whole idea of karma and what happens?
Well, let's get into intentions and human beings. We're quite complex entities compared to thermostats and tree leaves. And that's why it makes it more difficult to discern exactly what's going on here. But a person does something, and we see them do it, and it appears to... their action produces a result, and we assume that there was an intention there, that they intended to produce that result. But we realize that not all results are intentional. But we have an assumption that out of all these different actions, some of them were performed with the result in mind. And that's what we call intention, right? So anything that you do that has a function, go back to that, anything you do that has a function fulfills that function, and somehow or another it wasn't a complete accident or unexpected, begins to look like an intention.
Seems to me that we usually think of intention as having a thought process with a decision.
Yes, right. Yes. Yeah. We go to a new restaurant for the first time, we read over all the different things and we think about it, you know, and oh, that sounds good. But then the last time I had that in a restaurant, it wasn't nearly as good as I thought it would be. And, oh, that's way too expensive. Oh, that's got way too much fat in it. And so we think all these things and we finally end up ordering something on the menu. And all this thought went into it, you know. So it's an intentional action. I intended to order the blah, blah, blah. And our life's full of those kinds of things. Let me tell you something, though. First of all, you know that there are people who surgically had the two sides of their brain separated from each other. And there is a way that you can interact with those people so that you're interacting with only one side of their brain at a time, the two sides being disconnected from each other. The way that works is that everything in the right visual field goes to the left side of the retina, which goes to the right side of the brain, and everything in the left visual field vice versa. So you can show those patients things either here or here, and if you show them here, only the right side of the brain sees it. The left doesn't know what's there, and vice versa. And the right side of the brain controls the left hand, and the left side of the brain controls the right hand. And so in those split brain patients, the right and left hands can do things independently of each other. So you can communicate independently with these two sides and they can respond back. Now what they do there, if you show one side of the brain a picture of a chicken, flash that up, say on this side, so this side of the brain sees a chicken, and over here you flash I don't remember what they really used, but a picture of a snowstorm, say, right? Okay, so the left side sees a snowstorm. And the instruction, which two ears, two sides, each side hears the instruction, it says, from the cards on the table, pick the one that matches what you saw best. And so the two hands sort out the cards on the table, and the one on this side, that saw the chicken, actually, I should do it the other way around. I'm getting it backwards, because this is the side that talked. Okay, the chicken was on this side, the snowstorm was on that side, okay? Mm-hmm. Is that all right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, the right hand, which corresponds to the side of the brain that saw the chicken, picks up a picture of a chicken coop. And the left hand that saw a picture of a snowstorm picks up a picture of a snow shovel. And so then afterwards, which shows that each side matched, you did a good job of matching something with what it saw. And the other side doesn't know what the other side, what was seen by the other side. So then the experimenter says, well, why did you pick the picture of the chicken coop? Well, it goes with the chicken. And then you say that only one side of the brain can talk. So you say, you ask the next question, you say is, well then what is the shovel about? And this side of the brain that talks, that couldn't see the snowstorm, says, oh well that's because you have to shovel out the chicken coop. And that side of the brain doesn't even know that it's making this up. And there's also a lot of different kinds of neurological injuries that people have that make it difficult for them to do certain kinds of cognitive things in an ordinary way. And their brains do what's called confabulation. It makes up a story to explain things. That's what the technical meaning of the word confabulation is. The brain makes up a story. The person doesn't consciously think to themselves, oh, I've got to make up a story to explain this. They really believe this is the reason, this is what happened, whatever. Confabulation.
Well, there's a book about that, but your brain is not disconnected. It just came out. It's called Fast Thinking, Slow Thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the guy who wrote that? He won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago for economics, and he just wrote a book about how people make decisions. Does anyone remember who the author is? It's really interesting.
I don't know. Maybe you can come back and tell us.
Yeah, it begins with a K. Yeah, I will come back and tell you.
Okay.
I thought maybe someone else could.
But anyway, what I'm trying to get at here is there's all kinds of evidence that shows that what our minds do is makes up believable stories to make sense of things.
I do it all the time, and I hope my brain is connected both sides.
We all do it. We all do it all the time.
Person A and person B in the same.
We do it. I mean, if you're honest with yourself, how many times has somebody said, why did you pick this? And you listen to yourself make up a plausible story, but some part of you knew, you know, you say, well, I thought about this and I thought about that, and some part of you, no. It didn't really happen. So, but sometimes it does really happen. Sometimes you're in the restaurant, you're trying to make a decision, and you consciously weigh this and you consciously weigh that. Where the confabulation comes in is when you say, well, I decided. Yes?
So that speaks to intention versus our understanding of our intentions?
Yes.
It speaks to what?
Intentions versus our understanding of our intentions?
Yes. It speaks to where our intentions come from, what they really are, versus our subjective experience of intentions. So we have a subjective conscious experience of generating intentions. And the way we experience that is, I, whatever this mysterious word means, I decided to do this because I wanted that to happen. Right?
So what does that have to do with how we create karma in this world?
Well, because karma is intention. Now, every time, you probably don't have a problem with the idea that every time you go through a thought process and you think about this and that and you say, well, I want to get rich, so I'm going to exploit these workers and do it. You can say, well, that's bad karma, right? You know, I really like that person's watch and they left it on the table, so I'm going to take it. You know, that's intention. It's really clear. subjectively, but that's not all the karma is about, that kinds of intentions. Because what happens is that each time you go through a conscious thought process and decide to, for example, take something that's not yours, that's a result of a whole lot of stuff that's gone before. And it's also the cause of a whole lot of stuff that's going to happen afterwards. So, not all of the things that led to that conscious decision were all conscious to that degree. Many of them are habitual. Many of them are more or less like reflexes. And they were formed somewhere in the course of your life. The circumstances that you grew up in. If you grew up in a big family that was poor and somebody had something and you wanted it, you might have developed the habit of taking it. Right? And so when you're 40 years old, that still might kick in. You might still react in exactly the same way. Everything you do has an intention behind it in the sense that we were talking about earlier. Some part of your mind is trying to produce some simple result, like a thermostat. How the thermostat was created, we can leave that aside, but the thermostat is going to make the heat come on when it gets cool enough, or make the air conditioning come on when it gets hot enough, which it feels like it does. Right? And your mind is full of things like that. Your mind is full of things which, when a certain circumstances arise, a certain circumstance arises, it's going to initiate a course of action to produce a particular kind of result. And that all deserves to be called intention, even though there may be no conscious thought processes involved at all. But it's not distinct from those in which there's conscious thought processes. As a matter of fact, if we take an instance where there's a constant thought, a conscious thought process, and break it down, what we'll find is it's actually made up of a whole lot of these other things. And the when you make a decision, that you made the decision is a story that your mind tells itself. A lot of different tendencies operating in your mind independently contested with each other to produce a particular course of action.
The committee.
Right, the committee, that's right. And when the committee acts, then it's the result of the interaction of all of these. Sometimes it's the loudest committee member, sometimes it's the majority of committee members, sometimes it's a consensus, and all the committee members agreed to go along, even if they didn't really believe it was the best idea. There's all kinds of ways that the committee can come to the point of acting, but it's coming from a committee. When you say, I decided to order the salmon in the restaurant, what really happened is all those different committee members each contended, and somehow or another, at some point, there emerged a consensus or a decision out of that. And that's a conscious intention. Now, what's important in this is the more conscious you are of the process, then the more powerful the effect is going to be on your future behavior. So, you know, if you go to the restaurant and you glance at the menu and I've never heard of that stuff, but I've had salmon before, I'll order that. Doesn't have nearly as much effect as if you actually sit there and, well, maybe this, maybe that, maybe the other thing. So consciousness is an important part of intention. Not because consciousness is doing anything, but that the decision-making process is happening in consciousness. And if the decision-making process is happening in consciousness, it's making a much deeper, firmer, stronger imprint on the mind, and is going to have a lot more to do with what happens afterwards. So, get back to what the Buddha was talking about. He said, When I say karma, I mean intention. The intentions behind your actions, whether they're conscious or not, whether they've been deliberated upon or not, the intentions behind your actions are what's important. And every time the same intention arises and is acted upon, it's reinforced. Every time an intention arises but some countervailing intention intervenes, then it's weakened in the future because of that. And the more conscious this process is, the bigger the effect it has. And so one of his instructions to us was to practice right effort, which he said that is what, when something unwholesome has arisen, set it aside. If something unwholesome has not arisen, then consciously keep it from arising. When something wholesome has arisen, sustain that, encourage that. When something wholesome has not arisen, cause it to arise. That is making karma that will change your past karma. Mm. That is the intention. So these acts, what we subjectively experience as intention, is that process of consciously weighing and making the decision not to take what's freely given, not to engage in sexual misconduct, not to cause harm to other beings, not to tell a lie, not to say something that's going to set one person against another. Every time you deliberately do that, and if you have an impulse to do something, that's come from your past karma. Your past intentions have shaped your mind so that that impulse arises. And if you consciously practice setting those things aside and replacing them with positive behaviors, you are creating a completely different kind of karma, which will eventually change the way that you behave, the kind of person you are. That was the other thing that we were talking about, is results of karma are not what happens to you, they are who it happens to. Now, so if we take an example like, if you get hit by a meteor from outer space, there is no sense in the world that you can say, well, that's because of something that I did make that happen.
If you can talk at all.
Now, if you're going down a dark street and you get mugged, karma might have been a part of that, because you might be this kind of cheap, chintzy guy that's just not willing to spend $10 on a cab. Right? So your karma plays all kinds of roles. But karma is more about who it happens to, not what happens to you. Yeah. Who decided to walk down that street is the result of your karma. And then if you get mugged, whether it's this terrible earth-shattering thing or whether, you know, boy, was that ever stupid, I'm not going to do that again, you know, and you let go of it, that's your karma too. How much you suffer as a result of something is your karma. So, yeah.
It almost sounds like you're making a case for blaming the victim. There are plenty of things that, well, they, you know, bad things happen to good people. And you kind of don't want to go down the path of, oh, well, she should never have dressed like that in the first place.
Well, see, the thing is that the old version of karma before the Buddha came along really was blaming the victim.
Oh.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You were born crippled? Okay. Something you did in your past life. You were born an outcast? Okay. You know, it's your karma. I don't know what you did, but it must have been bad. You were born into poverty? Well.
Yeah, but if you're too cheap to buy a cab and you get thumped because somebody thinks you have money, there's some delicious irony there.
Isn't there, though? Yeah. Or maybe you didn't take a cab because you don't have any money.
And somebody still thought you did? Yeah.
So that's the thing, that why I said getting mugged isn't necessarily the result of your karma. But your karma could be what caused you to be there. So it's not really about blaming. It's just recognizing that we are responsible. This is another thing the Buddha said, that you are responsible for who you are entirely. And it's not really blaming the victim, it's liberating the victim. Because the whole victim psychology puts it in place of things happen to me that I don't deserve. And it assumes that however I'm reacting to those things, that's the only way you could react. Oh yes, and that's an easy way for us to think. But if you look, I mean, one of the worst things that's happened in recent human history is the World War II Holocaust that the Nazis did. But there's been some beautiful books written that clearly illustrate that not everyone suffered in the same way, even though exactly the same things happened to them. So there is a huge difference in terms of who you are that can determine how much, what kind of a victim you are, how much of a victim you are. And that's really what it's, that's really what we're getting at here. One of the worst things I've ever heard is that there was actually a Buddhist monk once who made the statement that, well, those 6 million Jews must have done something really terrible to deserve what they got. And that's exactly the kind of blame the victim, that the assumption that what happens to you is a result of your karma. But I would say that quite the opposite is true. It's who it happens to. What happens to you is a result of cause and effect. Now there is a sense, if in the deepest level, if we are not separate, if we're really all interconnected, then anything that happens to anybody is our karma. Right? And that's really where it becomes most meaningful, is when we stop, you know, and that's really the next step. While you still feel like an individual, you can make a lot of good karma that makes you be the kind of individual that doesn't suffer so much no matter what happens to you. But the next step beyond that is you stop thinking of yourself as a separate individual. But we don't need to go that far into it tonight. Yeah?
Yes. Did you point at me?
Go ahead.
Well, this question arose last Thursday, and I still have it. You've talked a lot about the committee, right?
Yes.
And how we think that we're making a decision, right? I made that decision, but it's, you know, really the committee who has.
Well, the real I is the committee.
Is the committee, right? Yeah. Now, within that space of the intention and of the committee that will come to a course of action, right? There is, within that system, there is the possibility for taking a different road when you're presented with a particular situation, right? Now, who makes that, you know, who is the one that makes that decision? I mean, is it this, the committee, how is that committee led towards making that decision that will bring you to the path of wholesomeness? Are you following me?
I believe that I am. The thing is that there's a difference between decisions that are made automatically and those that have some conscious processing associated with them. And one of the ways you could think of the difference of those is those decisions that are made unconsciously aren't really made by the whole committee. They're made just by one member or a few members. Those that are made consciously, there's much more participation of all the different parts of your mind. And this is one of the most important things that you can do, is you can train the committee to call in all of its members you can train the committee to research things before it makes a decision.
And that's where meditation...
That's where meditation and mindfulness comes into it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So much of your daily activity is in that category of being largely automatic. You kind of know that you're doing it, but you, for one reason or another, you don't really penetrate into what exactly is it am I doing, and why exactly am I doing this, and this is what I really want to do. Is it the best thing to do? Mm-hmm. We just kind of know that we're doing it, and that's what I mean, you know, that's, it's more or less automatic. Of all of the different parts of your mind, there's only a few of them involved, and they're most likely the ones that bear the strongest past conditioning to act in that way. So there's other parts of your mind that have acquired wisdom, that have different perspectives, that have different values, that if they were called to the table, you might have done something different.
So it's almost like opening your awareness to the presence of all of those voices.
That's exactly what it is. The first step is just being present and essentially inviting those voices to come, mm-hmm. and then listening to them when they do come. Yeah.
Okay. And that's what provides a space for them to be able to channel the intention towards something more wholesome.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right. Every time, I'll talk to you a little bit more about intention in neurophysiological terms. I don't know, you might find this boring. But I think it's really interesting, what science has to tell us about what's actually going on. And that is, neurophysiologically, an intention is an automatic action that hasn't been completed yet. Really interesting. So, until it's actually been completed as an action, you can become conscious that you're about to say this, mm-hmm. or conscious that you're about to do this. And other parts of your mind can moderate that and say, well, maybe not, or not so much, or something like that. Right? It's very interesting, a very simple experiment. Unfortunately, you can't do the kind of surgery on people they did that made this possible, but they monitored the electrical activity in a person's brain while they said, whenever you decide, they had a clock in front, so whenever you decide to push a button, notice where the hand is, sweep hand is on the clock. And that was recorded. And they monitored the electrical activity, and they found that the experimenter reading the EEG always knew before the person did that they had made the decision to push a button. It is possible for the person after that point to decide not to. So some unconscious process decides, I'm going to do this. That becomes conscious. That's the point at which, you say to yourself, oh, I've decided to do such and such. But it's also the point at which you, meaning the rest of what makes you up, can at that point choose not to go ahead with it and interrupt with it. So an intention is an automatic action that hasn't been completed yet. And then if it is supported, then the act comes to completion, and that is the intention that drove the action. But if it's interrupted, then it's a different intention. It's changed. You had a...
So it's putting the decision on hold until you can hear from the other voices.
Yes. That's a way of thinking. Really what you want to do is you want to train yourself to be more fully conscious. And I said that was one of the goals of meditation. Being more fully conscious means that both the part of your mind that focuses, that's attentional, and the part of your mind that takes in the global and the holistic perspective, the peripheral awareness, both of those are functioning, both of those are strong, you want to be in that state. Then you're suddenly confronted with a situation, and essentially you have much more in terms of your inner mental resources available to guide you in the decision-making process, rather than only those few strongly conditioned tendencies that leap to the surface immediately. So that's a difference. If it happens in that way, there doesn't need to be a particularly discernible time lag before the action, like for the simple reason that you had the whole committee available when the choice had to be made. But before you get to that point, to the degree that you can just learn to hold back a little bit and give a little bit more time, this will allow these other parts of your mind to come in and become a part of it.
Yeah, I just got to jump in here. I just went back to a place I used to live 7 years ago and have some good friends there. And I have some friends that are contentious sometimes. And man, I used to just get into a tangle before I even knew it had happened.
Yeah.
And really didn't care for that. And this time around the block, I saw the same people, they've got the same tendencies, but now I'm different. And I really felt as if there was piles of room between stimulus and response. And it must have been half of an eye blink. Must have been half of an eye blink, but it was just a corridor of mirrors.
Yeah.
And I watched that, and it's not like you have to stop and go, because out there they can't tell. But for me here, that half of an eye blink between stimulus and response might as well be from here to the moon. And it was night and day. Man, I was so happy to be able to keep my mouth shut.
I had a similar experience this week. Some friends came over, and I was showing them some of my latest paintings that I've been doing, and I brought this one. I said, I really like this one that I just finished, and I said, it's called The Machine of War. And I said, you'll notice there's a little cutout in it of a little girl, and I found it anyway to just get onto the point of what I decided. When I found it in a magazine, and it was from a larger photograph of a group of people during World War II who were about, unbeknownst to them, it was a photograph taken by an SS officer, and they were about to be taken to be decimated. And I just picked out this one little face, and I put it within the thing that I had made. And her husband was there too, and he was looking at it. I said, oh, that's interesting. And she just looked at it, and she said, excuse me, but I think I have to leave. And she's not Jewish, but she had to leave. Okay, what I would have done with that years ago, speaking about miles of, I would have said, because of my upbringing and what happened to me, is I'm bad. I was too emotional. I had too much imagination, and I know that my family can't take that. That's way too much. And I was bad, and I shouldn't do anything like this anymore.
Yeah.
And I saw that all in 2 seconds because I know, because of my, you know, my meditation practice, and I was able to just say, no, that's not true.
Yeah.
It's okay. That's her issue. I feel bad that she feels bad. I don't feel I have to call her up and apologize for my painting because there's nothing to apologize for. I'm not bad, but I'm having a little trouble feeling a little bit uncomfortable with her, I noticed, because she reminded me of this and of this struggle that's obviously still a little bit there, but that was great too.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not all gone yet.
But you could also, I mean, I didn't interpret it that way at all. I would say that would be like complete bullseye score if you had such a profound emotional response to a work.
Yeah, well, whatever.
But yeah.
I'm just telling you what happened to me and where I took it because of my own stuff.
Yeah, it's such a triumph.
Yeah. It was good not to
try.
Well, and that's the thing. You stopped.
Over it.
You didn't take it personally.
Exactly. I
mean, you didn't take it personally. Because you saw it more for what it really was.
Yes.
You saw the bigger picture. Than,
yes.
Oh, well, yeah. And you even see that she has the right to react that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, but you don't have to take that on yourself.
No, I don't have to fix it.
You don't have to fix it. You don't have to do anything about it. Yeah. So.
Right.
So, yeah. So, intention. Back to the volitional part of it. This is all. You see, if you understand intention as being more in this generic kind of things cause consequences, and we're very complicated things, you know, we're hundreds of billions of thermostats all wired together and interacting. Everyone by itself is just, you know, mechanical. But in their aggregate, they produce things that are far more complex and not so mechanistic. So, for example, Bank of America decided to put a charge on debit cards. And then just last week, they decided that they wouldn't do that after all. So that was voluntary, right? That was volitional on the part of Bank of America. But what on earth is Bank of America? I mean, did several hundred or thousand brick and glass buildings make this decision?
It's a person under the law.
Yes, it is. And really what I'm saying is that ordinary persons are really... Yeah, they're really corporations, you know. So we don't have any problem, on the one hand, seeing that these entities, the governments and corporations and societies and committees can make decisions and voluntarily do this rather than that, you know. At the same time that we realize that the entity... The way that we speak of it is a fiction, you know. And well, I guess if you're a Supreme Court justice, you don't realize it's a fiction. But the rest of us, I don't think, have any problem recognizing, you know, that Microsoft as an entity is a convenient fiction in our mind for all of these people in this hierarchical organization, and Bank of America. You know that first decision, there were a whole bunch of people sitting around a boardroom table, and not everybody agreed, and they discussed it at length. And one way or another, they decided, okay, we're going to do this. And then, more recently, many of those same people sat down at a similar boardroom table, and they probably still didn't all agree, but they came to a different decision, that they were going to change what they were going to do before. And that's the kind of thing that goes on inside of us.
Who processes the new information? If there's no us.
Who processes new information in Bank of America?
Yeah.
There's a lot of individuals at Bank of America that process the new information. The same thing with us. We have many subsidiary minds. Each is specialized to process certain kinds of information and passes it up to the next level. And at the next level, it takes information from a variety of different sources and integrates it and processes it, and it passes the results up to another level. Yeah.
Maybe next time we can touch on this. I just want to say it now so that I don't forget it. You mentioned cause and effect as the reason that things happen,
yeah.
As opposed to karma being how you react to it, basically, or how you perceive and receive things that happen. And I remember when I first started learning about Buddhism, I was told karma was cause and effect. And so I just wonder if that might, or maybe I'm trying to separate the two, and I think I get it, but maybe we can talk about that next time.
Yes, we can. But just briefly, the Buddha identified five different, he said everything is cause and effect. And then he divided it up into five different kinds, only one of which is karma. That's the kind that acts inside a mind like a human mind, to condition that human mind. He also said that there is physical causality, and that there is biological causality, and that there's psychological causality, and none of these three are the same thing as karma. Karma is just one kind of causality acting at one level, the way the Buddha defined it. And the fifth kind, that's four kinds, the fifth kind of causality is a kind of causality that can liberate you from suffering by overcoming the predispositions you have to see things in a way that they really aren't. So that's... Okay.
Now, I would love to hear more about what that causality, how it breaks down and how we see it in our everyday lives.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about that next week. We'll talk about the way all five of these kinds of causality interact, and we'll see how karma, the place that it occupies, the key place that it occupies. All right, thank you.
Thank you.